sit down.
So in the first step, the corresponding Friedmann equations of the framework will be derived, and second step, perturbations around FRW will be considered. And if there is time left, then comment why such a manifest negation van framework might be also when the quantization of general relativity is considered. And finally, I will give an outlook. Slide, please. When we observables in any theory, observables are by definition gauge invariant quantities. In the case of GR, the gauge group is of diffeomorphisms of the underlying manifold M. And the canonical fiction, then we have the Hamiltonian constraint C and the diffeomorphism constraint vector C, which generates spatial and, I'm in quotation marks, gauge functions. And the condition that a quantity O is gauge invariant over to the condition PO has to Poisson commute with the Hamiltonian constraint and the diffeomorphism constraint. And we know that the canonical is used to derive Einstein equations in the canonical picture, plus the linear combination of and thus is also constrained to vanish. Consequently, when we consider a gauge invariant quantity O, it necessarily also has to commute with the canonical Hamiltonian. Usually, this equation, Poisson bracket and the canonical Hamiltonian, is used to drive the evolution in the framework of general relativity. When we consider observables, we get always a frozen picture by definition, and this, of course, contradicts experiments, and this is known as the famous time in general relativity. Next slide, please. So an idea how this problem of time can be so-called relational formalism was introduced by Carlo Rovelli in the 90s and goes back to first ideas of Bergmann in the 60s. And the idea is that the Einstein equations, speaking, not be interpreted as physical evolution equations. What we should rather do is them as equations which describe the flow of unphysical quantities under gauge transformations. And the relational framework can then be used to define, nevertheless, observables, gauge invariant quantities, which have a non-trivial evolution. And the idea is that you take two phase-based functions, f and g, which are gauge variant, and we choose, for instance, to be the clock of our system. Next slide, please. And we have the following picture. We have these two gauge orbits of the functions f and g. Both being gauge variant move along the gauge orbit under the evolution of the constraint. And consider, for instance, on the left gauge orbit the point f of t1 and the other point f of t2. We know that these points differ only by a gauge transformation. Hence, we need to physically identify such points. So it makes no sense to speak about physical evolution along these gauge orbits, but what can be formulated in a gauge invariant manner is the evolution of f to the values that the function g takes while it moves along its gauge orbit. Next slide. So one can the gauge invariant extension of the function f, which I will denote by capital F, Ft, in relation to the values that, and this function F, gives them the values of F when, in this case, G takes the values 5, 7, 23, or any number. So suppose our clock T is mapped under a gauge transformation to alpha lowercase t of t, then what we have to do is we have to solve the equation alpha t of t is equal to tau for t, and suppose such a solution exists, and I will denote it by lowercase t, t of tau, then we use this solution for our observable f, which then becomes a function of tau and is no longer a function of the gauge parameter t. Next slide, please. And in 2000, the question?
Like, actually, at perimeter, we are having a lot of echo.
cannot hear you properly.
Yeah, we also. So I think somebody has a microphone on. Can they please switch off microphone? Could you check everyone?
So.
Okay.
I changed.
Okay, Christina, start again. Hello?
Hello?
Christina, can you start?
Okay, so in 2000, Rod, is it better like this?
Yes. It's not better here.
Okay. So Bianca wrote down a formula, an explicit formula for the observables in 2004. And she showed that if you consider a generally constrained system with a set of constraints Ci, then you take as many clocks as you have constraints Ci, and then wrote down a formula for these observables, which can be expressed in terms of a power series of clock variables Ti with coefficients involving multiple Poisson brackets of Ci and F. And of course, if we consider a general constraint system, the formula for F can become quite complicated. But nevertheless, with this formula, one has an explicit strategy how to construct observables for constrained systems, and in particular, for general relativity. And this formula was analyzed in several examples, in particular also applications to cosmology and cosmological perturbations by Bianca and. And one nice property of these observables is that they satisfy an automorphism property, meaning if we consider the Poisson bracket of two observables associated to F and F prime, then this is equivalent to the observable associated Poisson bracket of F and F prime. And moreover, if we consider a function of the elementary phase space variables Q and P, and we want to construct associated observables, then this is just given by the function F, where we replace the non-observables Q and B by their corresponding observables FQ and FP. And these are two properties I will need later on in my talk. Next slide, please. So the steps follow in this formula are the following. So the aim is to derive equations of motions for observables. And we consider a physical system, for instance, just gravity and some standard mass. And now we would like to construct or derive equations of motion for the observables associated to the gravitational and metallic system. And for simplicity, I will note these phase-based variables associated to gravity and metal just by QA and PA. And we add then an additional system to our gravity and metal system, which becomes the clock. So finally, we end up with a Hamiltonian constraint, which consists of the geometry and metal contribution, plus a contribution coming from the clock system. And I will denote the geometry and metal contribution just by C from now on. And same for the diffeomorphism constraint, where we have a contribution CA coming from geometry and metal, one coming from the clock. And now we can construct observables for the geometry and metal degrees of these constraints. And since we are not only interested in the construction of observables, but also in their evolution, we would also like to construct a physical Hamiltonian, which generates these observables. Next slide, please. And in the special case of deparametrization, I will explain in a second what I mean by deparametrization, all these steps I was mentioning before simplify. And we speak about deparametrization when it's possible to solve the Hamiltonian constraint for the clock momentum. In this case, the expression for the F, QA, and PA, and also the construction of the physical Hamiltonian simplifies. And I would like to mention that the physical Hamiltonian takes in general a different form for each chosen clock system. The physical Hamiltonian generates the evolution of this. In general, we also would have different motions for each clock system we choose, and then this equation of motion will be clock dependent. And for clarification, how such a physical Hamiltonian could look like in different cases, I would like to consider two examples. Scalar field without a potential, and the second one is also without a potential. Next slide, please. Let me start with this is also the case which is in cosmology, where phi is taken as a clock. In this case, we have a Hamiltonian constraint with a gravity and some other possible standard matter contribution C, and we get the contribution coming from the scalar field. And the same for the diffeomorphism constraint. CH hot is given by the geometry and matter contribution and additionally the scalar field contribution. And now we can use a trick which I will explain more in detail in the main part of my talk. And we use that the total diffeomorphism constraint vanishes, and then we can show, or one can show that the combination QAB phi, A, phi, B can be expressed in terms of the clock momentum squared, phi squared, and the diffeomorphism constraint squared of the geometry and matter part. And these combinations can then be plugged in the Hamiltonian constraint and the scalar field contribution, meaning that the total Hamiltonian constraint goes to vanish. We can solve this equation for pi and obtain that pi is equal to lowercase h phi function. And this double square root function includes geometry and matter degrees of freedom. There's no scalar field variables occurring in this function. And then one can write down an equivalent Hamiltonian constraint, e to the top, which is just given by pi minus h. And then one can construct observables for with constraints. And from now on, I will denote observables by capital letters. So the observable FQA will now become capital QA, and the same for the momentum. And then the evolution of these observables Q, A, and P, A is given by the Poisson bracket of the physical Hamiltonian and this variable. And the physical Hamiltonian is given by the integral over the lowercase h function. And in this function, I have the non-observables Q, A, and P, A, observables.
You have to stop. Somebody did something.
Sorry?
Too many echoes. Somebody must have switched on the microphone. Please switch off all your microphones.
I can't switch off mine.
It seems to be better now.
John, you could just switch off Anos, then you don't hear the others.
Okay.
So shall I start? Shall I continue?
Yes, go ahead.
So we ask for someone helping us, and I continue, or?
Yes, you continue.
Okay. So in this physical Hamiltonian, then occur the versions of the Hamiltonian and diffeomorphism constraints, where the lowercase q's and p's have been replaced by the corresponding observables. So that's the case of the scalar field. And next slide, please. So if we take a case, then we get the following version of the Hamiltonian and diffeomorphism constraint. Again, the geometry and matter contribution, and the contribution coming from the KSN field is given by the square root expression, and this alpha occurring in the expression is just a real number bigger than zero, which is a parameter for different tail sense models. And the diffeomorphism constraint is just pi phi comma a. And again, we use the same trick. We replace QAB phi comma a phase comma b expression in terms of the clock momentum squared pi squared and the square of the diffeomorphism constraint, and get again a lowercase h pi function, which only includes geometry and metal degrees of freedom. And then, in this case of the KSN field, the function looks a bit more complicated. It's again a double square root expression, but the function under the double square root is a bit more complicated than in the scalar field. Also here we can define an equivalent constraint just by pi plus h, and then construct observables with respect to these equivalent constraints. And then, as before, the evolution of these observables is generated by a physical Hamiltonian, which is in this case just the integral over the lowercase h function, where again the non-observables qa and pa have been replaced by the corresponding observables, capital Q and capital P. So we see in these two cases we get two different physical Hamiltonians, which has quite a different form. And next slide, please. I could also consider a system in which I would have a scalar field, geometry, matter, a scalar field, and KSN from the beginning. And then I could either decide to take the scalar field as a clock or the KSN field as a clock. And in the second case, I can do all the steps I have done before and end up with a lowercase h function, but in this case, the c and c a, which occur in the lowercase h function, are no longer the same, because in one case, the c would include the KSN contribution when I choose the scalar field as the clock, and in the second case, where I choose the KSN as the clock, the c would include the scalar field contribution. So in this sense, not only the form of the physical Hamiltonian might be different, but also the remaining constraint contribution which occur in a physical Hamiltonian might be different for different choice of clock. Next slide, please. So let me finally compare these two Hamiltonians which are obtained from a scalar field clock or a KSN field clock. And in order to be able to write them on one slide, I introduced the d-square shorthand for the square of the constraint contribution. And I would like to specialize these two physical Hamiltonians to an FRW symmetry. And in this case, the d-squares vanish because each contribution of the diffeomorphism constraint vanishes. And for the scalar field physical Hamiltonian H5, we see that the Hamiltonian is basically proportional to the square root of the FRW. For the KSN field, physical Hamiltonian is the FRW constraint. And the two CFRW, which are the Hamiltonian, do not vanish, because here we have added something to the physical system to become our clock, and only the total FRW constraint is supposed to vanish. So only if also the contribution of the clock is going to be taken into account. Okay, next slide, please. So we saw in this action that it depends on the clock how our physical Hamiltonian will finally look like. Now we would like to choose a clock and a ruler for general relativity in order to give space and time a physical meaning. And for GR, we know we have one Hamiltonian constraint per space point and three components of the diffeomorphism constraint per space point. So we would need four times infinity. And the most easy choice we can make is maybe for scalar field. But additionally, we would like the clock to be a good clock for cosmology. And in standard cosmology, what one assumes is a free-falling observer. So we would also like a clock which mimics the free-falling observer. what one moreover does in standard cosmology, one takes the Hamiltonian constraint as a true Hamiltonian in order to derive the evolution equations for the scale factor. So therefore, we would also like a physical Hamiltonian, which in the case of FRW is linear in containing FRW constraint contribution. Next slide, please. And such a clock was already around in the literature. It was long ago introduced by Brown and Kukash. And what they did is they added a so-called dust Lagrangian to gravity and the standard model. And this dust Lagrangian is defined as the space-time integral over the determinant of the space-time metric G. Then it includes a rho, which is basically a scalar function, and is the energy density of the dust material. Then it has the square of a vector field u mu. This vector field can be expressed in terms of other scalar fields, T, and scalar fields w, j, and s, j, where j runs from 1 to 3. And the configuration variables of this action are T, rho, and scalar fields w, j, and s, j. And if one analyzes the Euler-Lagrange equations of the system, one sees that u mu is a geodesic, and the fields w, j, and s, j are constant along each geodesic, and t defines proper time along each geodesic. If one considers the energy-momentum tensor, it turns out that it has the form of the one of a pressureless perfect fluid, so it's justified to call it dust. And we would now like to use the scalar field T, which should become our clock, in order to give time a physical meaning, and the three scalar fields Sj, for j equal to 1 to 3, should become our ruler. And the values that T takes under the gauge flow, I will denote by tau, and the values Sj takes, I will denote by sigma j. So that serves as physical references here. Next slide, please. We then do a canonical one-slip, and I will denote the conjugate momentum associated to T by P, and the one associated to Sj by Pj. And from now on, I will only consider gravity plus a scalar field, so the Qa and Pa elementary variables will include the 3 metric and its conjugate momentum, and phi and its conjugate momentum pi. And I will denote gauge variant quantities by lowercase letters and gauge invariant quantities by next slide, please. And if one considers a detailed constraint analysis, it's with second-class constraints, one ends up with only first-class constraints, and the Hamiltonian constraint is, again, the one coming from geometry and the scalar field denoted by C, plus the contribution coming from the dust, which has the following square root form. And for the diffeomorphism constraint, it's also the matter and the geometry and scalar field contribution, plus the contribution coming from the dust. And what Brown and Kukash, which is called the Brown-Kukash mechanism, is that the combination of the fields ET, J and Sj, which occurs in the Hamiltonian dust contribution, is exactly such that it is equivalent to the spatial diffeomorphism constraint of the dust. So I can rewrite the Hamiltonian contribution as the square root of pi squared plus QAB CA dust B dust. And by using now that spatial diffeomorphism constraint has finished, we can even more replace dust occurring now in the Hamiltonian constraint by minus CA geometry and scalar field. And if we do so, we are able to use the Hamiltonian constraint for P and the diffeomorphism constraint for Pj. And in order to solve the diffeomorphism constraint for Pj, as we can see in the expression for the diffeomorphism constraint, we have to assume that these S, comma A fields are invertible. Some assumption which enters the formalism. Next slide, please. So if we solve these Hamiltonian and diffeomorphism constraints for P and Pj, as in our examples before, we can write down set of equivalent constraints, which is then given for the Hamiltonian constraint by P plus H, where H is the square root of C squared minus GIV TACD. This H function contains only geometry and scalar field degrees of freedom. And for the spatial diffeomorphism constraint, we get a function HJ. Besides the geometry and scalar field variables PA and QA, still include dust variables SJ and T. We see that we only have obtained a partial deparametrization. We have a deparametrization for the Hamiltonian constraint because H is only a function of geometry and scalar field variables, but we haven't achieved such a form for the spatial diffeomorphism. But it turns out that constraints are mutually commuting, and in this case, the construction of the observable simplifies a lot. And moreover, since these constraints commute, we can even perform the construction of the observables in two steps. So first, we reduce respect to the spatial diffeomorphism constraint. So suppose we start with our gauge variant three metric QAB. Then in the first reduction, we construct spatial diffeomorphism environment quantities, which I will denote by Q tilde ij, sigma and t. These are no longer functions of x now, they become functions of sigma. And in the second step, we reduce with respect to the Hamiltonian constraint and construct from our spatial diffeomorphism environment quantities ij full observable capital Qij, which are then functions of sigma and tau. And next slide, sorry. The way how we construct diffeomorphism environment quantities is basically that we use, as I said before, these Sj fields, which we use in order to give space a physical meaning, are constant along each geodesic. So we associate to a base point x or x prime exactly those sigma values such that we sit on the geodesic which intersects in the point x or in the point x prime in the hypersurface. So if I assign certain sigma values, like here in this picture, then these correspond to certain values of my field Sj, and I can label geodesics basically by these sigma values. And next slide. The explicit formula is given by the expression on the top line of this slide, and one sees, as expected, it's an expression which is ultra non-local in X. It has to be because it's a spatial diffeomorphism environment quantity, but it's local in sigma. And in the second step, we then construct these full observables, which are also invariant under the Hamiltonian constraint. And these, also here, due to the deparametrization, the formula simplifies a lot, and it's just given by the sum of the iterative Poisson brackets, kind as shown below. And this H tilde of tau, which occurs in the iterative Poisson bracket, is defined as the integral over the range of sigma, which can be called the dust space, and tau minus spatial diffeomorphism invariant version of the clock function d tilde of sigma multiplied by the lowercase h tilde function of sigma. So for each elementary phase space variable, one performs then these two steps and obtains the full observable. Next slide, please. In principle, we have now a strategy to construct gauge invariant extensions for all geometry and scalar field degrees of freedom and get the corresponding observables, Pi and Qi. Due to the automorphism property, this is already enough because if we have certain functions of Qa and Pa, we know that if we want to construct the associated observables, these are just the functions of Pi and Qi. So, as I said before, we are mainly interested in the equation of motion of these observables. So what we also would like to construct is a physical Hamiltonian. that generates the illusion of these observables. And let me recall, of course, we cannot just use the canonical Hamiltonian because we know that this will commute with I and QI by construction. And since this is a physical Hamiltonian, it should be itself also gauge invariant. And it turns out that the physical Hamiltonian can be derived from the deparametrized version of the constraint. Next slide, please. So I have written down this equivalent version of the constraint, of the Hamiltonian constraint, which was just given by P plus lowercase h, which is only a function of the geometry and scalar field degrees of freedom. And now we would like to construct the associated observable to lowercase h. And due to the automorphism property, we know that we just have to use the same function where we replace lowercase q's and p's by their corresponding observables, and we end up with the square root of capital C squared minus the square of the capital CIs. And the physical Hamiltonian is then, as in the examples I gave in the introduction, given by the integral over the dust space of these capital H functions. And then one can show that indeed if one considers the evolution with respect to dust times tau, this is equivalent to the Poisson bracket of the physical Hamiltonian any observable. And moreover, it turns out that the physical Hamiltonian has certain symmetries. In the case of the dust, it commutes with Pj, which is basically the generator of spatial diffeomorphism in dust space. This is no longer a gauge symmetry because if we move one point to another point in dust space, this is really a transformation between physically distinguishable points. So it's an active diffeomorphism. And the second symmetry, the physical Hamiltonian, has that it commutes with the Hamiltonian density. And moreover, one can show that it has no tau dependence, so it's a conservative system. Next slide, please. So let me compare the unreduced framework, which is usually used in cosmology or GR, and the reduced framework. In the unreduced framework, we have equations of motions for our three metric, the conjugated momentum, and the scalar field degrees of freedom, and the canonical Hamiltonian is just given as a linear combination of constraints. Next slide, please. And then one can write down the second order time derivative equation of motion for the three metric. And if we do not assume any further symmetries, this equation look like this. Next slide, please. And moreover, we have constraints. So the geometry and scalar field part is constrained to vanish, and the same for the diffeomorphism constraint, where the geometry plus the matter contribution are constrained to vanish. In this reduced framework now, we have equations of motion for the invariant quantities, capital Qij and Pij, and the corresponding observables for the scalar field. And instead of a canonical Hamiltonian, which was defined as the integral over the dust space over the square root of C squared minus the square of the CI generated. And one can then use Hamiltonian in order to derive the Hamiltonian equation, and then, next slide please, second order time derivative equation for the observables, QJK. And it turns out that this equation looks very similar, apart from the red term in the last line. This is an additional term which we get. And this is due to the fact that we do not have an observer, an idealized observer, in the sense that it does not interact with the system, which is usually assumed in cosmology. Here, this observer is gravitational interacting with the system. So it's a kind of back reaction term. And the equation looks similar in the sense that if we replace these capital letters by lowercase letters, we would nearly get the same equation apart from the last term as we have in the unreduced framework. And n is denoting the left function here, and n vector the shift vector. And this G, capital G is just this form matrix, and kappa and lambda are capital. And of course, the dot refers to a derivative with respect to that time tau here, no longer with respect to the gauge parameter T. So next slide, please. And instead, if we take this reduced framework where the dust is added, it's no longer true that geometry and scalar field part of the Hamiltonian constraints vanish, only the total Hamiltonian constraints, including the dust, will vanish. And the same is true for the spatial diffeomorphism constraints. But instead, we get a kind of energy and momentum conservation, which we get through the symmetries of the physical Hamiltonian. So we know that the dust energy density and the dust momentum are basically preserved under the evolution of the physical Hamiltonian. And next slide, please. So I said we can match these two equations apart from the last term by replacing observable quantities by lowercase non-observable quantities. But strictly speaking, what happens in this unreduced framework is moreover that the lattice function and the shift vector become phase-based dependent. So they become dynamical variables. Not true in the usual unreduced framework where they are just functions of x. So no phase-based function. So strictly speaking, also this is the difference between these two equations. Next slide, please. So the idea is now, after having derived this manifestation via a framework for general relativity, to test this framework in the context of cosmology. And the first test which we would like to do is to specialize the QW dot equation to FRW spacetime and see whether we get something similar as the usual Friedmann equation. And in a second test, we would like to consider linear perturbations around FRW. And of course, then we would like to compare our results with the standard results and check that the dust clocks does not contradict current experiments. Next slide, please. So let us consider an FRW spacetime where the line element is given by this expression here, and A is scale factor. And if we express the line element in terms of conformal time, X naught, it can be expressed in terms of the Minkowski matrix eta mu u. Then one can make an ansatz for the three matrix QAB, which is A squared of T delta AB, and the corresponding momenta is given by minus 2 dot. And in FRW, the spatial diffeomorphism constraint vanishes identically. And then one can write down the first order Hamiltonian equations by using the canonical Hamiltonian. And by using additionally that the Hamiltonian constraint has to vanish, one ends up with the FRW equation shown in the box here. If we do the same step in the reduced framework, but using the physical Hamiltonian instead of the canonical Hamiltonian, we end up with the equation in the second box down here. And we see that, again, if we replace the capital A by lowercase a, this equation match apart from the rho dust, which occurs in the second equation, so which is again a sign that the observer we use occurs as a source term on the right-hand side of the FRW equation. So it's no idealized observer. It interacts with our observed system. Next slide, please.
Christina, can you hear me?
Sorry?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So I think a lot of people are lost here. So can you just, in the context of this cosmology, Friedmann cosmology, tell us the relation between the little a and the capital A?
The little a and the capital A. So the capital A would be if I perform these two steps how to construct observables. So it would be the little a located at a certain X, which I associate to these sigma values, then I would need to plug in this A into the iterative Poisson bracket of the construction of the observables, which are invariant. So it's basically this slide. So the capital A would be coming out of the second box, of the formula in the second box. So if you take, for instance, a scalar field as a clock, and you would calculate the capital A, then it's basically the small a and an exponential, which includes pi minus tau and some constant factors in front.
And up to now, everything you did seemed to be extremely formal before you came to the cosmological context, because it was not clear that those formulae could hold globally, either a given space-time or on the phase space.
No, I agree. I mean, in principle, it's complicated to construct these observables, but if I have the algebra and the physical Hamiltonian, I do not really need the existence of the observables.
No, I do not agree. So this is the confusion that we have.
But for cosmology, one can even construct them. So if you take the scalar field clock, which you usually use in cosmology, then this capital A would be the lowercase a times an exponential of phi minus tau.
Agreed. So my question was really, outside the cosmological context, what is the domain of validity of these considerations, even with Kukash and Brown, with the dust and so on? The geodesics will cross, the coordinatization would go bad. I agree that formally you can write down all those steps, but are we not hiding problems under the rug by doing formal calculations? For example, can we distinguish between real singularities and coordinate singularities which would occur because of dust crossing? This is all purely at the classical level without worrying about quantum theory.
So far it's on the classical level, but that's exactly, if I know the algebra of these observables, which I know from this automorphism property, and I have the classical physical Hamiltonian, then if I go to the quantum theory, I will find a representation for this algebra such that the physical Hamiltonian is supported. And then I have a quantum evolution in a sense, and I could perform similar tests concerning singularities.
Except for cosmological context, we do not really have algebra because these functions are not going to be globally defined. Your gauge fixing, your clock variables are not going to be good everywhere on the phase space. So there is some little domains of validity, and unless we know what these domains of validity are within the phase space, I do not see how we can talk about algebra of observables on the whole phase space. When we go to quantum theory, if we know something just in a little patch of phase space, we cannot take that algebra to full quantum theory because quantum wave functions, so to say, can have support everywhere. So there are approximations involved, and it would be very nice to know what those approximations are in the non-cosmological context. In the cosmological context, I completely agree with what you said.
Yes, okay, I agree, but I mean, the same might be true for the scalar field clock. You could run the same problems of the clock not being
Absolutely. That's why scalar field clock cannot be used in the full non-cosmological full general relativity. Absolutely right. I agree completely. I mean, the problem is really trying to behave as global clock. We have not been able to find anything. And I like the idea of, therefore, maybe we should not look at the full, but then we should specify what part of phase space and how much dynamic, how much time evolution allowed, given coordinatization. And unless we do that, I think we're not going to be making too much progress.
So the condition is, if I'm in a sector of the face where I can't invert these SJ, H, then this clock cannot be used. And there might be, I agree, globally, there might be situations where this is not possible. But
no, I want to say generically it will not be possible on the face space. There will be only some small patches on the face space where this will be possible. For
can you repeat it? I didn't hear it acoustically.
I believe that if you are outside the cosmological context, if you are in the full theory,
yes,
generically, you will not be able to do this inversion. In other words, if you give me one space-time, I would always be able to find regions where the required properties would stay. Geodesics would cross, the things would happen, and I agree that the same thing is true. Some, you know, some roots would become imaginary. And so I think that some of the big problem is not being, I'm not saying we should answer it immediately, but it's not even being raised. The domain of validity outside the cosmological context again of this formal consideration. And I would like to sort of urge everybody to worry about.
Maybe I can say something. Can you can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So the condition that Christina was just saying was that in this case that the determinant of this Jacobian going from x sigma is non-vanishing. Now this condition is very similar in nature to the condition that we always assume in canonical gravity that the determinant of the free metric is nowhere vanishing. But we just lift this in the quantum field. And in fact, in cosmology, this lift is the one that leads to the bounds that we have in quantum cosmology. So I think the point at the moment is that we're assuming that this algebra observes the fundamental piece of information, and whether this or not is invertible is somehow a quantum leap.
That could be a viewpoint, but that has to be kind of justified. I think conceptually, it's very different.
Could you repeat?
Having three metrics as being non-degenerate, we are extending the phase space and making sure by writing the equation in some way that Hamiltonian flows, constraint equations, etc., are still meaningful on this. In the introduction of clock, we are given the phase space altogether from the beginning.
I don't agree, because the determinant being non-vanishing is also an unholonomic constraint on the S variables, as well as the determinant of Q is nowhere vanishing. It's also an unholonomic constraint. So in both cases, I would say that we try to extend the phase space beyond the naive domain of validity.
All right. But in one case, we are actually shown that when the phase space is extended, the dynamics is meaningful. Namely, in the because the constraints are polynomial or whatever, so we can actually do this this extension. In the case that you are talking about now, if you are saying that you are extending this space, then the normal phase space that I have problems where under the evolution geodesics will cross. Now we'll get coordinate singularity. Now, if you extend any framework, the results you obtain in the normal phase space covered. And so I do not see how it is fine with me if we just continue with the talk because it's quite late, and then we discuss this quickly.
Okay. say that what is also different in the reduced framework is that we get a dynamical net and a dynamical shift vector, and in particular for the dust, it turns out that the latter function is proportional to Hamiltonian constraint contribution of the scalar field and the geometry part, and for the shift vector we get a proportionality to the spatial diffeomorphism constraint contribution of geometry and the scalar field. The next slide, please. Okay, so I stopped by saying that we can derive the MFW equation, where the difference is that the energy density of the dust occurs. So formally we would say the equation would agree, and we get our observer with. And the second test we want to perform is cosmological simulation theory. How much time do I have left?
I guess we still have a bridge until about 25 minutes.
25, okay. So I wanted to say first a few words how standard cosmological perturbation theory is done.
Can you remind us what slide you are on?
It's the one standard cosmological perturbation theory, Lagrange formalism. It's application to cosmology. Sorry, I didn't put numbers on. It's the one after the FRW equation.
Okay,
so usually one works in the Lagrange formalism, and the Einstein equations are then just given by the Einstein tensor G mu nu, the possible cosmological constant lambda, and this is equal to the energy momentum tensor, and we want to consider just gravity plus a scalar field psi. And I like to perform perturbations around FRW, so only the k equal to 0 case, and the signature is minus such plus time. And due to the symmetry, only certain Einstein tensor are vanishing, and they look very easy, very simple. But not component is just given by 3 times h, and h is the shorthand for a prime over a, where the prime refers to the derivative with respect to conformal time. And the spatial components of the Einstein tensor are just minus 2h prime plus h squared times delta ab. I denote quantities r to background FRW. So all quantities which occur with a bar are background quantities. And also in FRW symmetry, the of a scalar field is diagonal, so the not component is just a squared times rho, and the ab component is a squared times p times. Next slide, please. So if one then considers done by Mukhanov, Feldman, and Brandenberger in 1990, one considers the perturbation on the FRW matrix G bar, and also for the scalar field, one considers it around psi bar. Linear perturbations are defined R and psi minus. Any function of then expanded up to linear order in delta G and delta. And delta F denotes then the linear term in the tail X of C psi minus f of t bar psi bar. And if one expands everything up to linear order, then one obtains equation for the linear perturbation of, and also for the linear perturbation of scalar field energy momentum. And we know that these Einstein include the gauge degrees of freedom, and what one usually does composes this equation in scalar vector mode such that the degrees of freedom can be extracted more easily. And what one does is one is 11 quantities for scalar fields, 5 psi, d, and e. So both the vector field denoted by S and and the trace vector matrix on further tensor HAD, the capital Z for distribution. And then if one considers the linear perturbation of S, one can express this linear perturbation in terms of quantities, the upper box of the slide. Next slide, of the next slide, first. And one knows that the metric is not invariant under gauge transformations, and we consider only gauge transformations. So x mu is mapped to u mu. One can then, out of these seven quantities, one can construct seven invariant quantities by using the combination minus e prime and f in order to compensate the stage of the remaining seven quantities. So the seven invariants that one starts with are shown in the lower box, and these are then denoted by bold letters, type psi, VA, HAB, which is a linear order already gauge variant, and the bold phase. And we see that the scalar mode can be made gauge invariant by using the combination B minus E prime, and the vectors can components can be gauge invariant by using a combination of S and F prime. And then the 10 perturbed attributes we express in terms of these 7 invariants. But it turns out 10 Einstein equations in terms of 7 invariants that 4 of these equations do not contain second order time derivatives of 4 of the 7 fields. There are no evolution equations, but these are so 4 of these 7 can again be expressed in terms of the other 3. And in particular, what one gets is 0, and that phi and z can be expressed in terms of phi. What we end are finally 3 degrees of in the tensor A and in psi, change then. And this is also what we expected if we consider gravity plus a scalar field. We know we have 3 physical degrees of freedom. So we see, usually if we do standard cosmological perturbation theory, decide up to which order you would like to perturb your equations, and then you define your gauge invariant order by order. Of course, usually it's done in the Lagrangian formalism, but it has also been done up to linear order in the Langlois in 1995. And the aim is now to use the Bessel formalism in order to non-perturbation. Next slide, please. So in this manifestly gated framework, we have equations of motion for capital Q and observable associated scalar field, which is capital Q. And we saw if we specialize the alpha W background, we agree with the usual Friedmann equation. Now we consider perturbations of the observable metric Q and the observable scalar field. And we know that these perturbations in linear order are automatically gauge invariant because they just contain just differences of gauge invariant quantities. And of course, any power which I would perturbations will be also gauge invariant. This might be interesting for higher order perturbation theory. Gauge invariance becomes much more complicated in the standard frame. Next slide, please. And the formalism and derived the equation, the second order time derivative equation for the linear perturbations of the metric and the scalar field. And again, we agree normally by replacing lowercase letters capital letters, one term which again shows the influence of the dust interaction term of the dust system. Here, again, we would have expected such an additional term because we have interacting observers. And when we now really compare to the results which Mukhanov et al. Obtained and which we obtained, Then Lukanov and Arden, they use the gravity and the scalar field, and then use certain components of the metric to the clock. And here we use gravity field dust, and we use the dust as the clock. We did not use the metric because certain components of the metric, this does not parameterize anymore. It seems to become more complicated. So we see we have a different system. We are comparing two physically different systems. So let us carefully physical degrees of freedom that we consider gravity, scalar fields, and four. We start with 15 degrees of freedom instead of 11 degrees of freedom. We know that in the canonical function and the shift vector are pure gauge, so we have a reduction by 4 degrees of freedom. Moreover, we know that the Hamiltonian and the diffeomorphism constraints reduce the number of degrees of freedom by 4. Finally, we end up with 7 physical degrees of freedom, which is potentially dangerous framework because we have more, 4 more physical freedom. And in principle, we could see that we might contradict experiments because we could have certain modes of the metric which are physical in our framework, which are maybe such that we already run into contradictions with current experiments. And the reason that we have 6 physical degrees of freedom in the metric is again that we use the dust field for gauge number and quantities and not certain components of the free metric. So the question is, can we still match with the results obtained by Mukhov, Feldman, and Brandenberger, which have been experimentally confirmed? And in order to do so, we need to show that additional modes that we have are zero or decay. Next slide, please. As I mentioned before, in this reduced framework, we get a kind of energy and momentum conservation due to the symmetries of the system, that the energy density is a constant of motion, alpha w, and the same is true for the momentum density. If one considers now linear perturbation of the energy and momentum density, one can show that it's again constant of motion with respect to the perturbed Hamiltonian. And if one then considers the Feldman-Brandenberger framework and consider exactly these additional modes in the metric, as the following situation, that the Laplace of Va is equal to zero, the Hamiltonian and spatial diffeomorphism constraints, geometry and math, get a certain combination, or a certain combination of psi, phi, and z goes to vanish. If one compares situation in the reduced framework, it turns out that the Laplacian is no longer zero. It's minus kappa delta epsilon j transversal divided by a squared. Okay. So we see it's no longer vanishing in that framework, but we know that epsilon j, which is basically the perturbed momentum density, is a constant. So the term we get decays 1 over the square of the scale factor. And if we look at the combinations of s compared to the one of et al. Guess, we see that it's again non-vanishing. But also here, we get terms which are either of the order 1 over a or 1 over a squared, and multiplied by certain, by either the momentum density or the energy density. So in this sense, we say that we get additional physical modes, but these stay with the evolution of the unit. And in particular, one can show from these situations that in the limit of the vanished and momentum density of dust and vanishing perturbation, get exact agreement between these two. The next slide, please. So we saw that the vector formally and also that linear cosmological, we results agree formally with the one of Mukhanov et al., so it seems to be the case. It's a good clock for cosmological. And this was the aim, basically, to find good in cosmological situations. And so far, everything is purely classically. So let me, in the last few minutes, comment that such a framework also might be also an advantage when quantization is considered. So the advantages are that the constraints have completely disappeared from the picture. We do not need to do a Dirac quantization framework because the constraints have been reduced classically by constructing these observables. And what contains the physical information in this framework is the algebra of observables. So if we find representations of these algebra of observables, we have a direct access to the physical Hilbert space, which is, as we know, quite hard to achieve in the full theory and the structure. It might be a second way to get on the physical Hilbert space of quantum gravity. So the algebra of the observables is simple in the last case. So basically conjugated pairs. And we can easily find the representation of the algebra of the elementary. We could even just choose the representation. However, apart from the algebra, we also would like to quantize the evolution of the observable. So we are only looking for representations which additionally support the physical Hamiltonian assets. Since the physical Hamiltonian includes certain contributions coming from the Hamiltonian and the spatial diffeomorphism constraints, it's quite natural to choose the standard loop quantum gravity representation, which is used for the kinematical. In particular, this would be a representation where the physical Hilbert space has a volume operator. However, it's problematic to preserve the classical symmetries of the physical Hamiltonian, which were given by the commutation of the physical Hamiltonian with the Hamiltonian densities and with the generator of active diffeomorphisms. Because if we would like to define a spatially diffeomorphism invariant on this representation we use in the space, it has necessary to be graphed. And this would lead to an infinitely generous loop quantum gravity, which how to interpret classically. And moreover, which might be even more a problem, is that it would be non-separable. A second physical Hamiltonian is gravity framework. There one has one fundamental algebraic graph, and only this graph would not necessarily be preserved by the physical Hamiltonian. The problem with the additional infinitely many conservation laws in this context. One can also use the techniques of algebraic quantum gravity to quantize the physical Hamiltonian. And then one would have that is gauge theory formulation of algebraic quantum gravity. Quantized observables and the evolution on the lattice. However, in this framework, the issue of anomalies becomes because first the notion of a diffeomorphism space in these algebraic formulas, and the idea would be to define a master constraint-like functional which includes degenerators for the physical Hamiltonian square. And the square of the space with certain coefficients A and B. The condition that the physical Hamiltonian has no anomalies is the commutation of the physical Hamiltonian with these functional, and this is full GR, very complicated condition. Next slide, please. Finally, conclude. Time in GR has been circumvented by Dusker. The result is standard cosmological perturbation theory. The next step would, of course, be the second order and the quantization of the perturbations. And the beyond linear order, these manifestation frameworks should be of advantage because you do not have to bother about gauge invariants anymore. Your perturbations are automatically the gauge invariant from the gauge invariant quantity. And of course, of the physical Hamiltonian, which is available so far, discussed the anomalies, but it hasn't been tested very in detail whether these anomalies occur or not. So that's something that has to be improved. Once one has the physical quantization of the physical Hamiltonian, one could in principle develop Hamiltonian. In particular, one should answer the question how the stated square root Hamiltonian is in some sense the model Hamiltonian on the ground. And moreover, this Hamiltonian is or does time dependent, it's a conservative system, it might help when the vacuum problem quantum field theory occurs. So choosing dust as a clock, one could think of these dust particles as NIM particles, non-interacting massless particles, interpreted as the gravitational Higgs that we have to introduce to quantities. Hope for the future is to extract some physics out of loop quantum gravity such that working at an interface of a fundamental observation becomes. Thank you very much.
I guess we can have a few questions. Are there no questions?
I guess not.
Okay, then let's thank the speaker again.